business was Tenanta. Many people look forward to the day when they can stop working and retire to a more relaxing way of life. However, there are exceptions to that rule. And tonight we visit with a lady from Citadel who took that bill.
At the end of a long stretch of gravel road, running through the lush green countryside southwest of Chickwanga is an historical surprise. Nestled in the trees on the west bank of the Cedar River is the Cedarville General Story Post Office, looking much as it did 100 years ago when it was built. And the woman who runs the quaint old establishment has been in these parts all of her life. On June 2nd, Edith Essex celebrated her 83rd birthday, an event in itself. To make the day even more special, Edith was honored by Canada Post. For the many years she's been providing postal service to the area. 68 years ago, Edith began her postal career at the Cedarville office and has no immediate plans to give up the job she took on in 1921. She was 15 when she began working for her father, John Thompson, who got involved in the business in order to help out his friend, William Moxley.
Mr. Moxley's son went in storage, see? And we were out of the debt. One woman and song.
That's what we spent the money on.
Everyone seems to be surprised when they hear that she's actually been working for 68 years. We have a new club that we call the Heritage Club that we've put into place to acknowledge people who have put in long-term service, and generally those people, it's 25, 30 years. 68 years is pretty unusual.
In recognition of this unusual woman, Canada Post officials joined Edith's friends and family for a dinner celebration. But before the ceremonies could get underway, there was a mail to take care of first. At 1:37 p.m., the Cedarvale train appeared around the bend and made its scheduled stop at the Cedarvale Post Office. Edith had always picked up the mail herself, but if there were heavy packages, the train crew were quick to lend a hand. After a brief photo session with the star of the day, the crew hopped back on the departing train. But it had been a couple of days since mail deliveries on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of each week. With the mailbag tucked safely away in the small post office, the honors began. Canada Post officials made a series of presentations to Edith, including a gold watch and a set of 1910 postal scales from the Cedarvale office.
I think it's really important when someone like Edith dedicates her entire working life really to providing postal service, that we acknowledge that kind of commitment and dedication and say thank you, really.
After the ceremony, Edith shared her 83rd birthday cake with friends of all ages who also expressed their appreciation for her years of dedicated service. As we found out, Edith isn't one to blow her own horn. However, her friends were quick to recall the time she was proven her dedication. According to one friend, Edith walked to the post office from home more than 2 miles away, no matter how much snow or ice it was covering. She has also been known to write extra letters just so there would be mail in the bag. And speaking of them, even Josh Rob Kelly is always nearby. During our interview with his mistress, Kelly unabashedly bounded onto our outdoor set, stopping me as you do, until I managed to untangle him from the coils of microphone cord wrapped round and round his pie. When he is isn't busy sorting and dispatching mail or looking after the general store, he might be found working on his stamp collection or writing poetry. As a child, he did some clip poems from the local newspaper. In more recent years, she has published books of poetry, evoking the simplicity of her life in North Aurora, Northwestern D.C.
At the county post office of Cedarboro, the case frequently calls for mail. It was an inspection day and you may guess, the post office was an awful mess. Parcels scattered on the floor, mail bags stacked up by the door. Magazines and papers belonging to self piled up haphazard on the shelf.
Initially, Edith didn't envision herself actually writing poetry. She simply liked to collect it. But that changed unexpectedly one day.
I think it was because I had her that loud like him. And somebody saw him. And it disappeared. I mean, you know he did it, but he said he would improve these things. And I don't know, I would open the mouth and I would come to work and the tears were running down my face or something about the dog, you know. And then it was just broken time, you know. So then I would find her a little dog.
Things haven't changed much over the years at the store and post office. Memories of the past are everywhere. The old advertisements and signs pinned on the walls have yellowed with age. The wood stove and lanterns provide heat and light just as they did at the turn of the century. There's still no electricity in the dark and cozy rooms, but Edith doesn't seem to mind. One aspect of life, however, that has changed is the size of the community. There used to be a lot more people living in Cedarvale, working in the forest or on the railroad.
We used to sell those running boots and pants and shirts and leather vests and socks and washboards, brooms, outside of the
After almost 7 decades living in the same community and doing the same job, I asked Edith if she ever had a hankering to leave.
Probably if I had an education, I probably wouldn't be here, but, you know, can't leave without an education.
Edith may have only gone to school for 4 years of her long life, but that doesn't mean she hasn't received an education along the way. And there has also been an odd moment of excitement in this otherwise quiet community. Edith recalls the wonders when a Japanese incendiary balloon landed on the Seven Sisters Mountains, which stand guard on the other side of the Skeena.
This old Indian lady, she came over and told me, and I was got in touch with the authorities, and then they came out and they went up there and we could start things down. She gave a piece of rope for sitting here.
From the
And it's an Indian lady, she said that God was taking care of us, that's why we must move, you know, set the bush out in the woods, the country on fire. Yeah, that's what she said, that God was taking care of us.
Even though she does feel taken care of in her life, her 83 years may have been relatively quiet and simple, but that doesn't mean they've been boring.
Historically and spiritually. Welcome
come back on the show today, and we're going to hop on board the skier and do it for Chris Rupert, the skiers, along the way we'll meet some of the people who ride the rails and some of the characters on the roof. But our dream begins somewhere, and ours begins with Chris Rupert. Here's Valerie.
Prince Rupert is a city in the middle of the wilderness. The rainforest and the ocean is all around, and it feels and smells more like country than city. It has one of the deepest natural harbors in the world, so it's common to see huge freighters like this one anchored right off town, ready to be loaded up at one of the coal or lumber or grain terminals here. It was salmon and halibut that brought many of the early settlers to the area. By the turn of the century, there were dozens and dozens of canneries like this one, perched on pilings, dotted all along the coastline. This one, the North Pacific Cannery, was built in 1889. There are no more tins of salmon coming off the assembly lines, but in its heyday, 400 people, mostly European, Native, Chinese, and Japanese, lived and worked here several months a year. In 1985, it was turned into a museum and declared a National Historic Site. More rain and less sunshine than any city in Canada, but always looking for the silver lining in all those clouds, locals call it the City of Rainbows, and local singer and songwriter Kathleen Fong finds the inspiration in the gray sky.
She works as a letter carrier for Canada Post.
I think it's one of the prettiest jokes in Canada, actually. It's really pretty up here. It changes all the time. Every day it's different.
Bob, a Felton Plinkett, who was born in Telegraph Creek. He sold his carvings to museums and collectors all around the world. He had workshops in his basement, and his roots are very much in this land.
My grandmother's from Paris, and my family lives there, most of my family. And I'm, you know, I'm inspired here. I can do this here. I find, like, I like to live in the city, but there's so many distractions, there's so many.
Dempsey Bob is a master carver, and he feels it's incumbent upon him to pass on his skills and traditions to other young natives.
People are realizing what we have and what we've got to lose, and people are doing something about it. Like, that's what I've been doing with my teaching and carving.
Peter Lester has been the mayor of Prince Rupert for 31 years, which makes him the longest serving mayor in Canada. Some people say he's kept his job so long because he walks everywhere and is able to hear what people on the street are saying. Now, how have you managed to stay in office so long, 31 years?
Well, I guess the basic answer is that more votes than anybody else.
Not as the simple answer, but is there a political style you have?
Well, I imagine so. Everybody has got a style. It's just hardly defined it. I think I seem to suit the wishes of the majority of the voters, and I have been for many years. One of the secrets, of course, is not to get everybody mad at the same time.
One of these days, there'll probably be a statue of Peter Lester beside this man, who is Charles Melville Hayes, the founder of this city, with Hayes, who was a rich American industrialist, who brought the railroad here at the turn of the century. It was his vision that this would be the San Francisco of the North, and because it's that much closer to the Orient than Vancouver, the main Pacific port in Canada. But Ralph has more on that story.
100 years ago, Prince Rupert existed only in the imagination of Charles Melville Hayes, general manager of the Grand Trunk Pacific. But Hayes had a lot of imagination, Out of the rock of Cane Island, he built a town that would serve as the jewel of his railway's crown. The Grand Trunk Pacific was Canada's third transcontinental railroad. 19,000 kilometers of survey lines were studied before a final route along the Skeena River was chosen. The mountainous region along the river presented some of the most adverse conditions for railway building in all of North America. The men who made the grade worked 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 30 cents an hour. Thousands of tons of powder were used to blast the solid rock before the last spike was driven near Fort Fraser on April 7, 1914. That same year, the first trains began to arrive in Prince Rupert, linking it with the rest of Canada. But the man who started it all, Charles Melville Hayes, never lived to see his railroad realized. He died with thousands of other passengers on board the Titanic. This is Quincy Station. It was built in 1911. It's one of over 200 stations built by the Grand Trunk Pacific Railroad. The amazing thing about these is they had one of every 5 or 10 miles, kind of like a string of pearls across the country. But they were really pretty. They were functional, too. Through them came the orders that controlled and synchronized the movements of the trains. 4 years ago, the Quincy Station was saved from the wreckers brawl by a group of Prince Rupertites. The station was loaded onto a truck and taken to a barge waiting on the river. From there, it was floated 80 kilometers down the Skeena to its new home beside Prince Rupert's main CN terminal, now being restored as a museum. Stations like this would have half a dozen employees. This is the station agent's office. This is a very busy person. Not only were they responsible for conveying train orders, as well they had to handle the baggage, receive mail, send telegrams, and of course help the passengers. While we're here, let me take a look at the route we're going to be taking today. From Prince Rupert, we'll travel eastbound, past the Canada and Port Edward, through the communities of Terrace, Cedarvale, and New Hazleton. Our journey ends 300 kilometers later at Smithers.
Okay, all aboard! Midday rise oil!
Whoa!
Do
you want
to
play cards?
Not yet. We don't play cards, so you've been on for a while.
Oh, I'm playing.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, we'll play a gym, but I want to go see what people are like and all that, the scenery and stuff.
Should we go look
around? Yeah, let's take a look around.
Alright, here we are.
Hello.
Harold and Gray Taylor are two of the people riding the train today. Where are you from?
Seattle.
What are you doing on the Skeena?
for us, Bob?
Oh, sir, it's the terrace, our first stop. Let's have a look around.
Before we get going, I should tell you the weather changes around here just about every minute, so I think it's best to be prepared. This is Evie's Landing, and this is where terrace began.
It began in 1901 as a one-cabin relay point on the Dominion Telegraph Line. A few years later, the Eby brothers arrived and established a few shops to service the stone rollers plying the steamer. Then, in 1905, George Little, a visionary from Ontario, came to build his dream town. He bought land and started a sawmill. When the Grand Trunk Pacific was being built, he offered the railroad 7 free acres, longer named the station after him. So the town was called Littleton, later changed by the post office to avoid confusion with Littleton, Nova Scotia. The new name? Terrace, after the natural terraces rising from the Skeena. Today, this city of 11,500 is a major producer of forest products. George Little imported these trees from Ontario. They line Laxalle Avenue, Terrace's main street.
Like so.
The Terrace is best known for its hunting and its fishing. The sportsmen from all over the world are drawn to an area with the lure of reeling in a 40-kilogram salmon. Welcome story. The region is also home to a rare species of black bear, the white caribou, been adopted as the city's official symbol.
Hello.
Hi, ladies. One of the things that isn't rare in Terrace is hospitality. This is a heritage park. And here there are a collection of log homes that reflect the pioneer architecture of the time. There's a miner's cabin, there's a dance hall, a homestead house. But the real centerpiece is the Kingdom Lake Hotel. It was built there in 1920, used as a roadhouse, and it housed miners, hole cutters, and trappers. I love it here. Isn't it nice? I'd love to stay, but actually, I gotta catch a train.
Thank you.
We're going to meet someone wonderful in a few minutes. But first, here's Ralph with trainman Bob Brown.
Thanks, Valerie. Trainman Bob, tell me about Edith Essex.
Oh, she's a very special person. We've been up and down here for years. She makes us cookies, pies, all in all, she's just a super person.
This is the Skeena Valley, a wilderness wonderland and home to the hamlet of Cedar Valley. At the end of a gravel road on the edge of the river is the Cedarvale General Store. The building hasn't seen a lick of paint in more than a century, and the handwritten sign simply says store. 83-year-old Edith Essex is going to work. She and her dog, Kelly, walk the mile from her home 6 days a week. Mrs. Essex has been the postmistress here for more than 60 years. The constants in her life are the mail and the trains that drop it off 3 times a week. But even when no one comes by, she has her dog and her poetry to keep her company. Edith tends to her life as she's tended the small community over the years, gently, efficiently, and lovingly.
I'm going to give you a little bit of 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 a ever think of Plymouth? You ever think of this pack and ever think of anything?
No.
Grandchildren in Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver, Prince George, and Holland and one in Edmonton.
Right. Well, where do you call Holland?
Oh, Ottawa.
Ottawa.
So, do you travel much over a lot?
Not very much.
No,
yeah. Well, I was told that one of my granddaughters, she used to be a tour guide in Western Canada, and she told me how nice this trip was. And so I decided I would take it.
Was she right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Is it very
in the heart of a vast watershed claimed by the Kasan people. They never signed any land treaties with the Europeans who came here. The ownership of this land is currently being argued in BC Supreme Court. The Kasan community is strong and the language is still spoken by many of the elders. The focal point for Kasan culture is Kasan Village, which is managed by Keith Sampson.
So there is an ancient village here. Why did they build the Kasan Village here 19 years ago?
Well, because when they had the old museum, it seems like there was a high demand for more knowledge on the culture as well as the craft.
Can you tell me about this protocol?
Okay, this pole was raised in 1970 to commemorate the opening of that village. Kasan means, it's derived from the word Kitsan, meaning people of the river of mist.
Which is the Skeena in English.
Yes, which is the Skeena in English.
So what are the symbols?
Okay, the symbols here will represent the four tribes that are within the local area, and the four tribes are the eagle, the wolf, the frog, and the bottom figure will represent the fiery tribe. It's a mosquito transforming into a human, and there's a legend behind that particular figure.
What's the little man with a hat on top?
Well, the man in the hat represents the non-native involvement in helping build our village here.
The point of Kasan Village isn't just to be, gift and souvenir shop and a museum.
No, it's more of a cultural center. Here we teach our carving, silk screening, and also our dancing. We have the Kasan dances here.
We've got you here today, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
A special performance for Linda, so we can see that.
The legend is that the sun calls all the animals of the forest together for a feast. The trickster arrived disguised as a raven.
We have a film.
The wind realizes that we get trapped in this old trick again and blows all the animals away and leaves Wiget alone. In both his animal and human form. My name is Arbidec, Craig. My grandfather, Sir Alfred Smithers, is chairman of the Bangkok Pacific, and Smithers Town is named after him, and we'll be back after this.
Okay,
Craig,
I'll be
back
in a
ride for us. We're laying out at Smithers here. The train goes on to Jasper and across the rest of the country. Well, there are questions. There's a couple of people I wanted to steal Smithers. So if you could get the bags for us, I'd appreciate that.
Night!
The spectacular Bulky Valley. This piece of heaven is one of Canada's best kept secrets. Midway between Prince George and Prince Rupert, sandwiched between the Hazelton Mountains. The town of Smithers sits in this valley, population 5,000. It's a sports-minded spot, more reminiscent of Europe than Northwest BC. Somewhere else, the Bavarian-style storefronts might look contrived, but here, they seem to fit. You can't walk around Smithers without looking up. Hudson Bay Mountain commands attention at every corner. Smithers is a divisional point for the railroad. A lot of employees have made the town their home. Among them, two retired conductors, 71-year-old Jack Etherington and 88-year-old Frank Parker. Between them, they have close to a century of railroad memories.
You always know you want to work on the railroad? Well, I have lots of reasons to work on the railroad. My stepfather was a conductor, my uncle was a conductor, my other uncle was a hardhead. So a hardhead? Yeah, hardhead. That's all I know, isn't it? They called them hardwoods because we used to call the railroad cars because it burned so much fuel.
That's
the
way that the railroad can get around that railroad.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah.
And
with Ohio,
they had
90 years, which was all bush in there. All bush. It was Ohio. And Ohio, well, they had one that was up that street and down the hill across the river and then up on the other side of the river to Morristown.
The service changed a lot. I mean, the different time, and people like to romanticize trains, but the service all that much better for customers and the railroad.
And the service now is not that good, so.
Mm-hmm.
All pride in the work.
Yeah.
I think so. Pretty sure.
That's right, sir. Yeah.
I think there's a real close relationship with the crew. You know, and they pride themselves on looking well, and they seem to...
All these are diners.
The diners were really something.
Oh, look at diners.
And then when you went into a diner, the waiters all had small white aprons on, and at first they used to have three sittings, and go through the training, they find out whether they wanted to go to the first, second, or third sitting. But the stairs would always dress up, and every day would pass. Chair in the noon, white, and they had a silver bar with a red rose in it, and it was really something, a really pretty good service.
It was out of a leisurely trade or the passenger trade. How do you guys feel about that?
You still have to say, well, that was with the mode of transportation was really something. The train used to arrive here about 7 o'clock at night. Everybody in the town used to go down to see who was on the train and see the crews come off. And it was a daily thing.
Down here.
That's what I said.
Oh, I'm sorry to see this all, right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting being on the train because
in a way, it's probably part of the dying breed, you know? There's not a lot of people who travel on them anymore, but it was really a pretty nice feeling.
Yeah, it was, but given that the report on the trains is coming out later this week, I guess more of their fate will be decided as we go along. You know how they always say, welcome aboard to people when they start a new job? Mm-hmm. We thought, well, we're going to say welcome aboard to you. Welcome aboard, and then we put you on a train.
Well, it's a nice way to start. I hope the rest goes as well.
And we absolutely want to thank all the people along the way, from Rupert, Tara, Smithers, and the people from DOA, and of course our wonderful crew, too. I did such a great job. So it's okay.
It's okay.
Thanks for joining us on the train.
See you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.